application into this Constitution. House Republicans banged their hands together, and Lodge felt pleased as the applause guided him to his seat. House Democrats were silent, some probably jotting down and storing away his final statement. The Atlanta Constitution blasted the proposed voting rights bill as the stillborn child of hate. Segregationists were clearly already classing bills against racial discrimination as hateful. Mississippi Democrats remembered Lodge's closing statement when they gathered for their constitutional convention on August 12, 1890. Surprising Lodge, Mississippi Democrats adapted the North's anti-poor literacy test, reformulating it into an anti-black and anti-poor literacy test for their fourth constitution. The highly subjective understanding clause asked for someone to interpret something in the Mississippi Constitution, allowing racist registrars to pass ignorant whites into voting and fail knowledgeable blacks into not voting. When the new Constitution went into effect on November 1, 1890, anti-racist white lawyer and activist Albion Tourget immediately recognized it as the most important event in American history since South Carolina had seceded from the Union. Over the next decade, the progression of racism came to all the former Confederate states and even several border states. They all followed Mississippi's example, instituting race-veiled voting restrictions, from literacy tests to poll taxes, that would purge their voting rolls of the remaining black and many poor white voters without saying a racial word. The South, once again, defied the U.S. Constitution, this time without firing a single shot and without Northern retaliation. Blocked by a filibuster of Democratic senators, the force bill never passed, angering Frederick Douglass. But Du Bois remained calm and focused on the moral struggle of uplift suasion. When you have the right sort of black voters, you will need no election laws, Du Bois wrote in the New York Age. The battle of my people must be a moral one, not a legal or physical one. Black Americans were hardly losing any moral or cultural battles. They were being violently and nonviolently defeated in political and economic battles, as Du Bois would soon learn. The defeat of the force bill ended Republican efforts to enforce the 13th Emancipation and 14th Civil Rights and 15th Voting Amendments. If the bargain of federal non-interference was consummated in 1876, then after years of Northern and Southern reticence, it became the undisputed national policy in the 1890s and in the first decade of the 20th century. A series of separate but unequal laws was instituted, segregating nearly every aspect of Southern life, from water fountains to businesses to transportation, all to ensure white solidarity and black submission and to ensure cheap black labor. These separate and inferior black facilities fed whites and blacks alike, the segregationist idea of blacks being a fundamentally separate and inferior people. Segregationist ideas and organizing became a fact of American life in everything from the women's movement, where segregationist women were welcomed into the new National American Women's Suffrage Association in 1890, to the nation's newest leading labor association, the American Federation of Labor, AFL, which was a hotbed of discriminators. AFL President Samuel Gompers lectured black workers that organized labor was not antagonistic to the colored race. He claimed to know of only a few instances where colored workers are discriminated against. Gompers increasingly blamed black workers for their depressed economic condition in order to exonerate the discriminatory actions of his unions. Black people did not sit idly by during the segregationist organizing. Black resistance caused lynchings to spike in the early 1890s. However, the white lynchers justified the spike in lynchings as corresponding to a spike in black crime. This justification was accepted by a young W.E.B. Du Bois, by the middle-aged, ambitious principal of Alabama's Tuskegee Institute, Booker T. Washington, and by a dying Frederick Douglass. It took a young anti-racist black woman to set these racist men straight. Mississippi-born Memphis journalist Ida B. Wells recoiled from the lynching of friends and the sheer number of lynchings during the peak of the era in 1892, when the number of blacks lynched in the nation reached a whopping 255 souls. She released a blazing pamphlet in 1892 called Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases. From a sample of 728 lynching reports in recent years, Wells found that only about a third of lynching victims had ever been charged with rape, to say nothing of those who were innocent of the charge. White men were lying about black-on-white rape and hiding their own assaults of black women, Wells raged. Wells knew that immoral constructions about black women hindered them from fully engaging in the burgeoning women's club moral movement that cascaded across the 1890s. I sometimes hear of a virtuous Negro woman, but the idea is absolutely inconceivable to me, wrote an anonymous Southern white woman in The Independent. Oberlin graduate and teacher Anna Julia Cooper took it upon herself to defend black womanhood and encourage black women's education in A Voice from the South in 1892. Like Wells, Cooper wrote in the anti-racist feminist tradition, "The colored woman of today occupies, one may say, a unique position in this country," Cooper explained. "She is confronted by both a woman question and a race problem, and is, as yet, an unknown or unacknowledged factor in both." And yet, Cooper did espouse some class racism. She praised, for instance, the quiet, chaste dignity and decorous solemnity of the Protestant Episcopal Church, while demeaning the semi-civilized religionism of low-income black Southerners. Southern white men were shielding themselves behind the plausible screen of defending the honor of their women through lynchings in order to palliate their record of hate and violence, Ida B. Wells maintained in Southern Horrors, and again during her 1893 anti-lynching tour of England. Her speaking tour was an embarrassment to white Americans. In her work, Wells more or less condemned the strategy of uplift suasion and championed armed black self-defense to stop lynchings. "The more the Afro-American yields and cringes and begs," she declared, "the more he has to do so, the more he is insulted, outraged, lynched." The pro-lynching president of the Missouri Press Association, James Jacks, published an open letter to attack Wells and all black women who, in his view, were nothing but thieves and prostitutes. If Jacks hoped to silence Wells and her sisters, then his plan backfired. By the summer of 1896, inflamed black club women had united under the banner of the National Association of Colored Women, NACW, to defend black womanhood, challenge discrimination, and lend power to self-help efforts. But some, if not most, of the self-help efforts of these mostly elite reformers encouraged the assimilation of white women's mores. They were based on the same old historical racism that said that low-income black women had been morally and culturally ruined by slavery. "Lifting as we climb" became the NACW motto. After 2 years of study abroad in Germany, W.E.B. Du Bois returned to the United States in 1894. Slater Fund officials declined to extend funding for his study abroad, which would have enabled him to defend his economics doctoral thesis. Though he intended to prove black educational capacity to Slater Fund officials, he looked like a special education teacher pursuing a physics doctorate. No matter what Du Bois did, he could not persuade away racist ideas. If blacks pursued the European world's most prestigious degree, they were looked upon as stupid for doing so. If they did not pursue it, then they did not have the natural talent, as Rutherford B. Hayes said in 1890, provoking Du Bois. Even Du Bois' settling for being the first African-American to earn a Harvard history doctorate in 1895 brought on racist ridicule. In elite white circles, Du Bois became known as one of those half-dozen Negroes who had allowed Harvard to make a man out of a semi-beast, as New Yorker Franklin Delano Roosevelt exulted as a Harvard freshman in 1903. Though Du Bois' educational success in Germany did not prove much of anything to American producers and consumers of racist ideas, Du Bois did prove something to himself. He had grown more accustomed to meeting not white folks, but folks. He mentally climbed in Germany and stood on an equal plane with white people. But his new anti-racist mindset of not looking up at white people did not stop him from looking down at supposedly low-class black people. It would take Du Bois much longer to see not low-class black folks, but folks on an equal human plane with him and the rest of the white folks. Du Bois accepted a position in 1894 teaching Greek and Latin at the AME Church's flagship college in Ohio, Wilberforce. He was determined to begin a life work leading to the emancipation of the American Negro. Somehow, some way, he maintained his faith that American racism could be persuaded and educated away. The ultimate evil was stupidity about race by the majority of white Americans, he theorized. The cure for it was knowledge based on scientific investigation. Whereas Du Bois wanted to educate Americans about the capacity of black people for the higher pursuits, Booker T. Washington, the calculating 38-year-old principal of Tuskegee, wanted black people to publicly focus on the lower pursuits, which was much more acceptable to white Americans. Booker T. Washington claimed the vacancy of race leadership that had been vacated upon Frederick Douglass's death in 1895. Ida B. Wells would have been a better replacement, but she was a woman, and too anti-racist for most Americans. In private, Washington supported civil rights and empowerment causes across the South throughout his career. In public, his talking points reflected the New South racism that elites enjoyed hearing. At the opening of the Cotton States International Exposition on September 18, 1895, Washington delivered the Atlanta Compromise. He asked Southern whites to stop trying to push blacks out of the House of America and to allow them to reside comfortably in the basement, to help them to rise up, knowing that when they rose, the whole house would rise. Many of the landowners in the Atlanta audience had spent their lifetimes trying to convince their black sharecroppers to dignify and glorify common labor. So when Washington beckoned to them with the words, "It is at the bottom of life we must begin, and not at the top," they were overjoyed. "Be rest assured," Washington said, "the wisest among my race understand that the agitation of questions of social equality is the extremest folly." Amid the excited applause from thousands, the waving handkerchiefs, the flowers pulled from white women's bosoms that showered Washington when he finished, New South editor Clark Howell of the Atlanta Constitution sprinted up to the speaker's platform. He shouted, "That man's speech is the beginning of a moral revolution in America." Washington's words were telegraphed to every major newspaper in the nation. Editors published raving reviews. Democratic President Grover Cleveland arrived in Atlanta and called Washington the new hope for black people. "Let me heartily congratulate you upon your phenomenal success at Atlanta," W.E.B. Du Bois glowed in a telegram on September 24, 1895. It was a word fitly spoken. Not every black commentator was like Du Bois applauding Washington, however. Calvin Chase of the Washington Bee did not see compromise, but death to the Afro-American and elevating to white people. Death or not, Booker T. Washington grasped the national acclaim, attracted philanthropists like Andrew Carnegie, and built the Tuskegee Machine, an institution that over the next decade ruled black colleges, businesses, newspapers, and political patronage. And a year after Washington had loudly issued the Atlanta Compromise with Southern segregationists, the U.S. Supreme Court quietly followed suit. For years, the U.S. Supreme Court had been stuffed with Northern-born corporate lawyers, happily wielding the 14th Amendment to cut down laws violating the liberty and civil rights of capital to dictate the wages and working conditions of labor. The court provided no such protections for the liberty and civil rights of workers, women, immigrants, and black people. On May 18, 1896, the court ruled 7-1 in Plessy v. Ferguson that Louisiana's Separate Car Act and other new Jim Crow laws violated neither the 13th nor the 14th Amendments. The biracial Homer Plessy had challenged the law requiring Louisiana railroads to provide equal but separate accommodations for white and black passengers. New Orleans Judge John H. Ferguson had claimed that the foul odors of blacks in close quarters made the law reasonable. The Louisiana Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Ferguson's ruling. In his majority opinion, Supreme Court Justice Henry Billings Brown relied on racist ideas to support a policy that was clearly discriminatory in intent. It was his job to obscure those intentions. Justice Brown evaded the politics of the Louisiana Separate Car Act, evaded the discriminatory intent, and evaded the obvious shoddiness of the rail cars for blacks, and instead semantically classed it as social law that merely recognized the social distinction between the races. If one race be inferior to the other socially, the Constitution of the United States cannot put them upon the same plane, wrote the former Detroit corporate lawyer. The lone dissenting voice to the Plessy ruling was hardly an anti-racist voice. Though he did not doubt that whites would forever be the dominant race in this country, Justice John Harlan of Kentucky wrote, "In the view of the Constitution, in the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior dominant ruling class of citizens. Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens." On May 18, 1896, the New York Times buried the Plessy decision on a third-page column focusing on railroad news, reflecting the case's marginal news coverage and the nation's marginal awareness of its significance. The Plessy decision legalized what was already assumed by the New South in America, separate but unequal, and branded it equal for courts and consciences to stop anti-racist resistance. The social conscience of America was a significant political factor during this period. It was the beginning of the progressive era. Though it is popularly remembered as a time of heartfelt social concern and awareness, in reality, the progressive era was rigged by elite white men and women. It was dominated, at least from the standpoint of its elite funders and organizers, by a desire to end the social strife caused by industrialization, urbanization, immigration, and inequality in the 1880s and 1890s. Cotton Mather's Blessings of Order Through Benevolence still held the philanthropist's ear from Boston to Atlanta after all these years. The projected benevolence of the Plessy ruling and the Atlanta Compromise seemed to bring a finality to the disorder of the Negro problem. Indeed, the finality of the Negro problem as the 19th century closed meant a United States dead set on playing down the Southern horrors of discrimination and playing up what was wrong with black people. Chapter 23, Black Judases. After Plessy v. Ferguson reportedly solved the Negro problem, British physician Havelock Ellis proclaimed that a new question had presented itself. The question of sex, he said, with the racial questions that rest on it, stands before the coming generations as the chief problem for solution. It was an overly ambitious prediction in the first medical treatise on homosexuality, Studies in the Psychology of Sex, 1897. Western nations were still not ready to sufficiently deal with the reality of multiple sexualities, at least not in public. Ellis, nevertheless, tried to put sexuality on the progressive era's agenda. This self-described friend of the yet unnamed LGBT community popularized the term homosexual, classifying it as a congenital physiological abnormality or sexual inversion. Ellis aimed to defend homosexuality against the law and public opinion that regarded homosexuals as criminals in the late 19th century English-speaking world. Similarly, racist scholars had long conceived of blacks as criminals, and of blackness as a physiological abnormality, debating all along about whether it was congenital. Sexologists, inspired by scholars of race, were already using the comparative anatomy of women's bodies to concoct biological differences between sexualities at the turn of the century. While racist scholars were distinguishing between the free and prominent clitorises of negresses and the imprisonment of the clitoris of the Aryan American woman, homophobic scholars started claiming that lesbians will in practically every instance disclose an abnormally prominent clitoris. This is particularly so in colored women. To sexist thinkers in the late 19th century, the more prominent the clitoris, the less chaste the woman, and the less chaste the woman, the lower the woman on the hierarchical scale of womanhood. Hence the convergence of racist, sexist, and homophobic ideas that deemed both white lesbians and black heterosexual women to be more chaste and higher on the scale of womanhood than black lesbians who reportedly had the largest clitorises. When men, black heterosexual women, or white lesbians viewed black lesbians, bisexuals, or transgender women as biologically or socially inferior, as less chaste, they were speaking at the intersection of racist, sexist, and homophobic ideas. They were articulating queer racism. But it was difficult to find a scholar willing to engage sexuality, let alone sexuality and race, and increasingly even race. W.E.B. Du Bois had begun his career trying to present solutions to the Negro problem to white intellectuals. But many of these intellectuals now felt it had been solved by Plessy, or it would be solved by the natural selection of evolution or extinction. A statistician for the Prudential Insurance Company predicted the imminent extinction of black people in his epic book that relied on the 1890 census figures. Unlike the Plessy ruling, Frederick Hoffman's Race, Traits, and Tendencies of the American Negro received plenty of attention in 1896, packed with statistical tables and published by the American Economic Association. The book was a pioneering work in American medical research, and it catapulted Hoffman into scientific celebrity in the Western world as the heralded father of American public health. At the time of emancipation, he wrote, Southern blacks were healthy in body and cheerful in mind. What are the conditions 30 years after? Well, in the plain language of the facts, free blacks were headed toward gradual extinction, pulled down by their natural immoralities, law-breaking, and diseases. Hoffman supplied his employer with an excuse for their discriminatory policies concerning African Americans, that is, for denying them life insurance. White life insurance companies refused to insure a supposedly dying race. Yet another racist idea was produced to defend a racist policy. In a critical book review, W.E.B. Du Bois argued that Frederick Hoffman had manipulated statistics to present his prediction of black extinction. Hoffman's native Germany, Du Bois pointed out, had death rates that matched or exceeded that of African Americans. Were Germans headed toward extinction? Du Bois mockingly asked, before rejecting Hoffman's supposition that higher black death rates indicated imminent black extinction. But Du Bois could not reject Hoffman's supposition that higher black arrest and prison rates indicated that blacks actually committed more crimes. Not Hoffman, not Du Bois, no one really knew the actual crime rates. All of the instances of Americans breaking the law, whether caught or not. But the higher black arrest and prison rates substantiated the racist ideas of more black crime. And these racist ideas spun the cycle of racial discrimination in the criminal justice system. More suspicions of black people, more police in black neighborhoods, more arrests and prison time for black people, and thus more suspicions, and on and on. In all of his intellectual power, Du Bois proved unable to stop the cycle of racial profiling and crime statistics and racist ideas. He substantiated the disparities in arrest and prison rates through both anti-racist, dogged Anglo-Saxon prejudice has subjected blacks and whites to different standards of justice, and racist explanations, the day's freedmen lacked a moral foundation. Du Bois was far from alone. None of the scholars who became members of the first national black intellectual group, the American Negro Academy, formed in 1897, could reject the statistics or refute them as indicators of greater black crime. Instead, they accepted the numbers as fact and tried to push against the stereotypes of criminal blacks through education and persuasion, thus reproducing the racist ideas they were working to eliminate. For instance, in his 1897 address for the opening meeting of the American Negro Academy, entitled The Conservation of Races, Du Bois put forth the argument of biologically distinct races with distinct histories, characteristics, and destinies. African Americans were members of a vast historic race that from the dawn of creation has slept, but half awakening in the dark forests of its African fatherland, he said. The first and greatest step toward the settlement of the present friction between the races, that is, toward social equilibrium, he said, lies in the correction of the immorality, crime, and laziness among the Negroes themselves, which still remains as a heritage of slavery. The speech was hastily published, circulated, and acclaimed. Du Bois and the American Negro Academy hoped the pamphlet would refute the popular conception of the destructive, decaying, dying African in the post-Plessy, post-Hoffman era. But it was riddled with racist ideas, speaking of blood races, race traits, backward Africa, and brooding enslavement, criminally minded and effeminate African-American men, strong Europeans, and the idea that African-Americans were superior to continental Africans. Du Bois reinforced as much racism as he struck down. Du Bois was also working on a more anti-racist tome, however. As a visiting researcher at the University of Pennsylvania in 1896 and 1897, he worked on the Philadelphia Negro, a thoroughly anti-racist social study about racism being the spirit that enters in and complicates all Negro social problems. And yet, he was unrestrained in his moral attacks on the poor, on black criminals, and on women, saying, for example, that it was the duty of Negroes to solve the problem of black female unchastity. Though the book is now regarded as a classic sociological text, only a few academic journals reviewed it upon its release in 1899. One anonymous reviewer in the leading American Historical Review commended Du Bois for laying all necessary stress on the weakness of his people, and then ridiculed him for believing that these supposed weaknesses could be cured. Reading this review, Du Bois should have gathered that, when he tried directing his readers from the crossroads of racist and anti-racist ideas, they oftentimes would not reach his desired anti-racist destination. Then again, Du Bois, like his elite black peers, hardly considered his critics' attacks on the black poor and black women to be racist. Whatever Du Bois achieved, whatever he published, he failed to gain the following or the financial support of Northern philanthropists that Booker T. Washington enjoyed. On his fundraising travels, Washington had a knack for putting white audiences at ease by sharing his famously funny or infamously offensive Southern darky jokes. Washington gave wealthy whites what they wanted, a one-man minstrel show, and they gave him what he wanted, a check for Tuskegee. Washington somehow demeaned black people as stupid for an hour and then received donations to educate those same stupid people. Washington was ingeniously playing the racial game, but it was a dangerous game to play at the end of the 19th century. A surge of racist violence to snatch black economic and political power spread from North Carolina in 1898 to Georgia in 1899. Du Bois witnessed some of this violence in Georgia. He had taken a professorship at Atlanta University in 1897 and had started spearheading annual scientific studies on all aspects of Southern black life. But in April 1899, he became heartbroken over his inability to prevent the infamous lynching near Atlanta of Sam Hose, who had killed an oppressive white employer in self-defense. In August, armed blacks in coastal Georgia's McIntosh County drove back a lynching mob. One could not be a calm, cool, and detached scientist while Negroes were lynched, murdered, and starved. And secondly, there was no such demand for scientific work of the sort that I was doing, as I had confidently assumed would be easily forthcoming, Du Bois later wrote. Firmly believing that the majority of Americans would rush to the defense of democracy if they realized how race prejudice was threatening it, Du Bois adopted a more aggressive commitment to educational persuasion. In July 1900, he attended the first Pan-African conference in London, sponsored by Booker T. Washington. To be sure, the darker races are today the least advanced in culture according to European standards, said Du Bois in assimilationist style. But they had the capacity to one day reach those high ideals. And so, as soon as practicable, Du Bois proclaimed, there should be decolonization in Africa and the Caribbean. Du Bois's rationale for gradual decolonization, black nations were not ready for independence, echoed the old racist rationales for gradual emancipation, black people were not ready for freedom. Du Bois echoed those proclaiming in 1899 that Cuba, Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, the colonies the United States had received from winning the 1898 Spanish-American War, were not ready for independence. Segregationists and anti-racists opposed, while assimilationists supported the formal launching of the American Empire. In a poem printed in McClure's magazine in 1899, the literary prophet of British imperialism, Rudyard Kipling, urged Americans to take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed, go send your sons to exile to serve your captives' need, to wait in heavy harness, unfluttered folk and wild, your new-caught sullen peoples, half-devil and half-child. Imperial assimilationists won the debate among the mostly white male electorate. If President William McKinley's successful re-election campaign in 1900 was any indication, his running mate, Theodore Roosevelt, declared in 1901, "It is our duty toward the people living in barbarism to see that they are freed from their chains, and we can free them only by destroying barbarism itself." While U.S. leaders publicly debated the colonial people's capacity for civilization and assimilation, they privately debated military bases, puppet politics, natural resources, foreign markets, and war costs. This public humanitarian debate, which was also a private political economic debate, became a 20th century staple as the American empire publicly and privately warred to extend its sphere of influence. At home and abroad, a profound political racism cast non-whites as incapable of self-rule, or capable of self-rule one day in order to justify both their subjection and their resulting socioeconomic disparities. Some black newspaper editors saw through the mask, connecting the nation's foreign racial policy to its domestic racial policy. They blasted the robbers, murders, and unscrupulous monopolists, to quote the Salt Lake City Broad Acts in 1899. "The federal government could not deal justly with dark-skinned peoples," another paper blared, as evidenced by its do-nothing record at home. In this new American empire, American racist ideas went through what seemed very much like a revolving door, constantly going out into the colonizing world and then coming back into the country after conditioning the immigrant minds of the people arriving in the United States in the early 1900s. When Irish, Jewish, Italian, Asian, Chicana, Chicano, and Latino people in America were called anti-black racial epithets like greasers or guineas or white niggers, some resisted and joined in solidarity with black people. But most firmly embraced the racist ideas, distancing themselves from black people. Blacks in the early 20th century would joke that the first English word immigrants learned was nigger. On January 29, 1901, the lone black representative George H. White of North Carolina gave his farewell address to Congress. About 90% of the nation's black people resided in the South, but they were no longer represented by black politicians in the state legislatures and in Congress. Their mass disenfranchisement and charges of incompetency leveled against black politicians by white ones had made sure of that. "This, Mr. Chairman, is perhaps the Negro's temporary farewell to the American Congress," said White. "But let me say, Phoenix-like, he will rise up someday and come again." Not many believed him. As White trotted out of the hall, the leading American historians and political scientists looked upon him as the Reconstruction era's final defective product in the nation's capital. At the time, William Archibald Dunning reigned as the director of Columbia University's preeminent Dunning School of Reconstruction History. The school was at the forefront of an academic revolution, highlighting the objective use of the scientific method in the humanities. For the first time, meticulous and thorough research was carried on in an effort to determine the truth rather than to prove a thesis, was how one historian described the impact of the Dunning School in the American Historical Review in 1940. The truth, though, meant Dunning School historians of the Reconstruction era chronicling the white South as victimized by the corrupt and incompetent black politicians, and the North mistakenly forcing Reconstruction before quickly correcting itself and leaving the noble white South to its own wits. All the forces that made for civilization were dominated by a mass of barbarous freedmen, Dunning supposed in his 1907 classic, Reconstruction, Political and Economic, 1865 to 1877. Dunning trained a generation of influential Southern historians who became department chairs and dominated the discipline of history for decades in the 20th century. His most notable student was Georgia native Ulrich Bonnell Phillips, In American Negro Slavery, 1918, along with 8 more books and a duffel bag of articles, Phillips erased the truth of slavery as a highly lucrative enterprise dominated by planters who incessantly forced a resisting people to labor through terror, manipulation, and racist ideas. Instead, he dreamed up an unprofitable commerce dominated by benevolent, paternalistic planters civilizing and caring for a robust, amiable, obedient, and content barbaric people. Phillips's pioneering use of plantation documents legitimated his racist dreams and made them seem like objective realities. Phillips remained the most respected scholarly voice on slavery until the mid-20th century. Until mid-century, the Dunning School's fables of slavery and Reconstruction were transferred into school books, or at least into those that mentioned black people at all. Most textbook writers excluded black people from school books as deliberately as Southern Democrats excluded them from the polls. But the greatest popularizer of the Dunning story of Reconstruction was none other than a novelist, Thomas Dixon Jr. In one of his earliest memories, Dixon witnessed a lynching in his North Carolina town. "The Klan are guarding us from harm," his mother told him that night, indoctrinating him into the racist justification for white terror. When he came of age, Dixon wept at the misrepresentation of Southerners inflicted by Northerners upon seeing a theatrical version of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Vowing to share the true story, he composed a Reconstruction trilogy of best-selling novels, The Leopard Spots, A Romance of the White Man's Burden, 1865 to 1900, 1902, The Klansman, A Historical Romance of the Ku Klux Klan, 1905, and The Traitor, A Story of the Fall of the Invisible Empire, 1907. His goal was to teach the North what it has never known, the awful suffering of the white man during the dreadful Reconstruction period, and to demonstrate to the world that the white man must and shall be supreme. In the fictional trilogy, which was taken as historical fact by millions, Dixon posed Reconstruction as a period when corrupt, incompetent Northerners and black legislators ruled, terrorized, disenfranchised, and raped Southern whites until they were redeemed by the might and virtue of the Ku Klux Klan. Nothing arrested the national mind and the hazards of black voting. Nothing justified the do-nothing attitude better than this racist fiction of Reconstruction, whether it was written by novelists or by scholars. As the all-white, all-male Congress settled into Washington in 1901, these white men were able to ease any twinges of guilt they may have felt by reading Booker T. Washington's hit autobiography, Up From Slavery. Washington expressed faith in God, took personal responsibility, worked mightily hard, overcame incredible hardship, and saw racial progress and white saviors at every turn. White savior stories were fast becoming a fixture in American memoirs, novels, and theatrical productions. They were enjoyed by Americans of all races as hopeful signs of racial progress. Individual stories either reflected or deflected common realities. The individual white savior stories cleverly deflected the reality of white saviors for a few, and white discriminators for the many, along with the reality of racial progress for a few, and deferred progress for the many. The release of Up From Slavery in February 1901 allowed Booker T. Washington to stand at the height of his career. W.E.B. Du Bois watched the national ovation for Washington's memoir. As the praise carried on into the summer of 1901, and as Du Bois looked up at Washington on the white pedestal of black leadership, it all started to become too much for him to bear in silence. In his review of Up From Slavery in Dial on July 16, 1901, Du Bois fired the first shot in the civil war between Washington's Tuskegee machine and Du Bois's elite civil rights activists. In addition to scolding Washington for his accommodation, Du Bois scolded those leaders who represent the old ideas of revolt and revenge, and see in migration alone an outlet for the Negro people. AME Bishop Henry McNeil Turner had for years preached that God was a Negro, but he urged African Americans to migrate to Africa so that they could leave all the discriminatory policies behind. Du Bois reduced all back-to-Africa efforts, including those on black terms, and violent protests against enslavers and re-enslavers to revenge and hate. Anti-racists were not defending black humanity and freedom, he said, as Ida B. Wells had so eloquently advocated doing. It was customary for assimilationists to charge anti-racists and segregationists with being hate-filled and irrational. These fabricated labels would marginalize anti-racists throughout the 20th century, would one day even marginalize the elderly anti-racist Du Bois. But in 1901, Du Bois began to criticize the accommodators and the anti-racists in part for his own purposes, in order to set the stage for as large an important group opposing the Tuskegee machine, those reformist, assimilationist, seeking self-development and self-realization in all lines of human endeavor, in order to allow blacks eventually to take their place alongside the people of other races. Washington's Up From Slavery remains an American classic. However, in 1901, another book, released weeks before Up From Slavery, received much more praise. The American Negro, What He Was, What He Is, and What He May Become. For years, William Hannibal Thomas had tried to desegregate white institutions. He had preached, taught, and written to uplift blacks, eliminate racial distinctions, and forge a world where black people would be accepted by white people as their own. But according to a pre-release preview by the New York Times, Thomas had presented his subject without an atom of sentimentality. Thomas described a black record of lawless existence, led by every impulse and passion, especially immorality and stupidity. 90% of black women, he said, were lascivious by instinct and in bondage to physical pleasure. They were living lives of filth without parallel in modern civilization. Thomas thought at the junction between assimilationist and segregationist ideas. He argued that a minority of blacks, by which he meant himself and his kind, had overcome their inferior biological inheritance. These extraordinary Negroes showed that the redemption of the Negro was possible, and assured through a thorough assimilation of the thought and ideas of American civilization. Thomas advocated restricting the voting rights of naturally corrupt blacks, policing naturally criminal blacks, placing black children with white guardians, and pursuing uplift suasion. Blacks should conduct themselves so worthily as to disarm racial antagonism, he advised. As Thomas tried to distance himself from blackness through the American Negro, it was, ironically, his very blackness that caused white Americans to shower him with the adoration he so desired. Since racist ideas deemed every individual black person an expert and representative of the race, black people like Thomas had always proved to be the perfect dispensers of racist ideas. Their blackness made them more believable. Their blackness did not invite defensive mechanisms to guard against their racist ideas about black inferiority. Racist Americans, from the nation's most eminent sociologists to ordinary readers, held the American Negro as the most authoritative, believable, and comprehensive tract ever published on the subject, better than Du Bois's The Philadelphia Negro. William Hannibal Thomas was placed next to Mr. Booker T. Washington as the best American authority on the Negro question, said the New York Times. Within black America, however, Thomas became known as Black Judas. Activist Addie Hunton actually classed Thomas a Judas Iscariot in her piece, Negro Womanhood Defended. Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois hated the book. Mr. Thomas's book, Du Bois charged in his review, was a sinister symptom of the age, which desired nothing more for the Negro than to kindly go to the devil and make haste about it, so that the American conscience could justify 3 centuries of shameful history. After black leaders dug up dirt on Thomas and destroyed his credibility, he fell into obscurity. He passed away as a black man in 1935. He never did become white. On October 16, 1901, the newly sworn-in President Theodore Roosevelt, hearing that Booker T. Washington was in town, invited the most distinguished member of his race in the world over to the president's house for family supper. Roosevelt did not think much of the invite, clearly unaware of the mood of segregationists. When Roosevelt's press secretary casually notified Americans the next day of Washington's visit, the social earthquake was immediate and loud. Black Americans were beside themselves in glee, and many fell in love with Theodore Roosevelt. But to segregationists, Roosevelt had crossed the color line. When Mr. Roosevelt sits down to dinner with a Negro, he declares that the Negro is the social equal of the white man, stammered a restrained New Orleans newspaper. South Carolina Senator Ben Pitchfork Tillman was not restrained. The action of President Roosevelt in entertaining that nigger, he said, will necessitate our killing 1,000 niggers in the South before they will learn their place again. Tillman showed in this statement the real purpose of lynchings. If racist ideas won't subdue blacks, then violence will. Roosevelt learned his lesson, and he never invited a black person to the president's house again. But he failed to quiet segregationists by officially naming the president's residence the White House. Blacks were beasts, segregationist books were declaring in the early years of the 20th century, starting with Mississippi professor Charles Carroll's The Negro a Beast, 1900, and beasts should not be dining at the White House. In the midst of this overpowering segregationist discourse, W.E.B. Du Bois had the audacity to publish the most acclaimed book of his career. Released on April 18, 1903, the book title decreed in profoundly anti-racist fashion that blacks were not soulless beasts. Black folk were fully human, and Du Bois made Americans listen to the strivings and the souls of black folk. Decades later, James Weldon Johnson, the composer of the Black National Anthem, sang the praises of Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk for having more impact upon and within the Negro race than any other single book published in this country since Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was a perfect comparison. Like Uncle Tom's Cabin, Du Bois's 14 essays drilled much deeper into the American mind, the racist construction of complementary biological race traits of the humble, soulful African complementing the hard, rational European. Blacks should be fostering and developing the traits and talents of the Negro, Du Bois proposed, in order that someday, on American soil, two world races may give each to each those characteristics both so sadly lack. Black people were the sole oasis of simple faith and reverence in a dusty desert of dollars and smartness. It was a racist idea to suppose that the racial groups were not equal, and that a racial group lacked certain human characteristics. In 1903, white people did not lack simple faith and reverence, and black people did not lack materialism and smartness. Ironically, many of the northern defenders of slavery and abolition, and now Jim Crow and civil rights, had attested to the simple faith of humble blacks and the smartness of strong whites. In The Souls of Black Folk, Du Bois tried to revolutionize the dividing ideal of race into the unifying ideal of race. This unifying ideal of race would not only heal the United States, he argued, but also heal the souls of black folk. In the book's most memorable passage, he explained further, "This American world yields the Negro no true self-consciousness, but only lets him see himself through the revelation of the other world. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at one's self through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." Blacks must therefore reckon with the fact that the history of the American Negro is the history of this strife, this longing to attain self-conscious manhood, to merge his double self into a better and truer self, Du Bois wrote. He simply wishes to make it possible for a man to be both a Negro and an American. It was as if many of his black readers had been straining all these years to do precisely what he had described. Du Bois's theory of double consciousness finally gave many of them the glasses they needed to see themselves, to see their own inner struggles. Just as Harriet Beecher Stowe's book met many white folk where they were, at the warring crossroads between segregationist and assimilationist ideas, Du Bois met many black folk where they were, at the warring crossroads between assimilationist and anti-racist ideas. Du Bois believed in both the anti-racist concept of cultural relativity, of every person looking at the self from the eyes of his or her own group, and the assimilationist idea of black individuals seeing themselves from the perspective of white people. In Du Bois's mind, And for so many like-minded people, this double desire or double consciousness yielded an inner strife, a conflict between pride in equal blackness and assimilation into superior whiteness. While his opening essay was timeless, his timely case against Mr. Booker T. Washington and others carried the book into controversy in 1903. Du Bois had given his opening argument against the Tuskegee machine 2 years earlier, and there was no leaving the courtroom now. After again disparaging Washington's accommodators and then the singly conscious anti-racist, Du Bois asserted the standing of his doubly conscious group, which he named the Talented Tenth, the top 10% of black America. They knew that the low social level of the mass of the race is responsible for much discrimination against it. But they also knew, along with the nation, that relentless color prejudice is more often a cause than a result of the Negro's degradation. The Talented Tenth sought the abatement of this relic of barbarism and not its systematic encouragement. Du Bois identified the Talented Tenth in another published piece in 1903 that was riddled with more assimilationist ideas and class racism. There are in this land 1 million men of Negro blood who have reached the full measure of the best type European culture, Du Bois judged. It was the duty of this aristocracy of talent and character to lead and civilize the masses, to filter culture downward, and to show the capability of Negro blood. However, he complained, as this Talented Tenth is pointed out, the blind worshippers of the average cry out in alarm, "These are exceptions. Look here at death, disease, and crime. These are the happy rule." Of course, they are the rule because a silly nation made them the rule. Du Bois fumed about the extraordinary Negro conception, this silly conceptual loophole to uplift suasion. But, somehow, he kept his own faith in the potential of the silly strategy of uplift suasion. Du Bois's call to arms in the souls of black folk to strike down those accommodating to Jim Crow was as insightful and impassioned and racist as William Lloyd Garrison's call to arms to strike down the colonizationists accommodating slavery. And segregationists and accommodators instantly knew it. "This book is indeed dangerous for the Negro to read," admitted the Nashville American. The Outlook chided Du Bois rather accurately for being half ashamed of being a Negro. Then, the reviewer held up Booker T. Washington, rather inaccurately, as unashamed. The Tuskegee machine tried to suppress the book, to no avail. Black newspapers, free of Washington, usually shouted the same thing: "Should be read and studied by every person, white and black," as the Ohio Enterprise put it in a headline. University of Pennsylvania sociologist Carl Kelsey, speaking for racist white scholars, admonished Du Bois for emphasizing the bad, the discrimination. "Prejudice will cease," Kelsey wrote, "when the blacks can command the respect and sympathy of the whites." In the aftermath of the Souls of Black Folk and Du Bois's Talented Tenth essay, racial reformers and scholars of race, whether white or black, whether applauding or critiquing Du Bois, seemed to have formed a consensus on the solution to the Negro problem. They spoke of the need for more strident uplift suasion, for upwardly mobile Talented Tenths persuading away the racist ideas of white folk. The strategy remained deeply racist. Black people, apparently, were responsible for changing racist white minds. White people, apparently, were not responsible for their own racist mentalities. If white people were racist and discriminated against blacks, then black people were to blame because they had not commanded whites' respect? Uplift suasion had been deployed for more than a century, and its effect in 1903? American racism may have never been worse. But neither its undergirding racist ideas, nor its historical failure, nor the extraordinary Negro construction ensuring its continued failure had lessened the faith of reformers. Uplift suasion had been and remained one of the many great white hopes of racist America. Chapter 24. Great White Hopes. In May 1906, W.E.B. Du Bois welcomed to Atlanta University the nation's most eminent anthropologist, a Columbia University professor who was actually questioning segregationist ideas of blacks as beasts. Franz Boas had immigrated from Germany in 1886, when American racial classifiers were almost uniformly identifying the organic inferiority or blackness of his Jewish people. The predominant mouth of some Jews, one anthropologist maintained, was the result of the presence of black blood. Boas's own experiences with anti-Semitism had shaped his hostility to segregationist ideas of biologically distinct races and ethnicities, of the natural human hierarchy of racial and ethnic groups, that is, ideas positioning whites over blacks and further positioning lily-white Anglo-Saxons over semi-white Jews. Franz Boas attended Du Bois's Atlanta University conference on the health and physique of the Negro American. Scholars questioned or rejected the widely held impression that races were biologically distinct and that cardiologists could actually distinguish black blood, and that below the skin and hair, doctors and scientists could actually distinguish a black body or a black disease. Du Bois presented, but he also learned about the absence of scientific proof for his long-held biological race concept. 2 days after the May 1906 conference, Boas delivered Atlanta University's commencement address. To those who stoutly maintain a material inferiority of the Negro race, he proclaimed, the past history of your race does not sustain that statement. Boas then astonished Du Bois and probably many of his black students by recounting the glories of pre-colonial West African kingdoms like those of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. Boas awakened Du Bois from the paralysis of his historical racism, or, as Du Bois explained it, from the paralysis of the commonly held judgment taught to me in high school and in two of the world's greatest universities, that Africans had no history. Du Bois's intellectual high, that May, came crashing down with black America by the end of the year. The day after Republicans used black votes to regain the House in the 1906 midterm elections, President Theodore Roosevelt ordered the dishonorable discharge and loss of pensions of 167 black soldiers in the 25th Infantry Regiment, a black unit that had been a huge source of black pride. A dozen or so members of the regiment had been falsely accused of murdering a bartender and wounding a police officer in the horrifically racist town of Brownsville, Texas, on August 13, 1906. Overnight, the most popular U.S. president in black communities since Abraham Lincoln became the most unpopular. "Once enshrined in our hearts as Moses," shouted out a Harlem pastor, the Reverend Adam Clayton Powell Sr., "Roosevelt was now enshrouded in our scorn as Judas." In the final days of 1906, it was hard to find an African-American who was not spitting ire at the Roosevelt administration. Roosevelt's efforts to regain black support with new black federal appointments failed. Sounding the indignation of the observant press, the New York Times reported that not a particle of evidence had been given to prove the men were guilty. Roosevelt was defiant in his annual message to Congress on December 3, 1906, defiant in his crude attempts to gain Southern white voters. He warned respectable colored people not to harbor criminals, meaning the criminals of Brownsville, and then he turned to lynchings. "The greatest existing cause of lynching is the perpetration, especially by black men, of the hideous crime of rape." President Roosevelt was speaking to a national choir of scholars. In Pure Sociology, 1903, Brown sociologist and former abolitionist Lester Ward had claimed that black men who lusted after and raped white women and the white mobs who lynched them in retaliation were both ordered by their racial nature to do so. In Lynch Law, 1905, Wellesley economist James Elbert Cutler argued that in executing criminals, the white mobs were merely acting in their sovereign capacity. Even Du Bois complained in a 1904 Atlanta University study, Some Notes on Negro Crime, particularly in Georgia, that there were enough well-authenticated cases of brutal assaults on women by black men to make every Negro bow his head in shame. "Negroes must recognize," he said, "their responsibility for their own so-called worst classes." When black criminality ceased, lynchings would cease, and black criminality could cease through education at schools like Hampton and Tuskegee, President Roosevelt suggested. While in past years Booker T. Washington had rejoiced when Roosevelt had promoted his program, this time he probably felt uneasy. Given advance notice, Washington begged Roosevelt to reconsider the discharge, knowing the Tuskegee machine would also feel the wrath of black America. As Washington fell with Roosevelt, Du Bois's talented tenth rose in influence. Theodore Roosevelt did not become toxic in white communities. his groomed presidential successor, William Howard Taft, cruised to victory weeks before African Americans lauded a victory of their own on December 26, 1908. At the center of the victory was a Texas-born colored heavyweight champion, the first counter-punching boxer in a sport of brawlers who had finally received his shot at the heavyweight championship and knocked out Tommy Burns in Sydney, Australia. No event in 40 years has given more satisfaction to the colored people of this country than has the signal victory of Jack Jackson, reported the Richmond Planet.